You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The narrator of A.M. Holmes' latest novel, May We Be Forgiven, is Harold Silver, a detached, untenured academic in a loveless marriage. The story opens with several horrible events that force Harry to confront and try to repair his fractured family. It's fast-paced and includes a gruesome killing, a Richard Nixon subplot, and an African bar mitzvah. This is Amy Holmes' 10th book. It is published by Viking Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome her. She's also a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. But more important, she's come back to our show to talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Didn't this novel begin as a short story intended for a collection put together by Zadie Smith?
It started with Zadie asking me to write a piece for the anthology she was doing for Dave Eggers, and then didn't finish in time. And then I gave her something else. And then Granta asked for a piece for its 100th issue. And it still wasn't done, and I kept giving them other things. And finally, I literally snipped off this sort of first chunk and thinking that would be it. And the novel really just kept going and kept going.
Well, it kept going to become a 480-page novel.
Yeah.
But the story starts rather quickly in the first 15 pages. Is adultery, a number of deaths. Was that the short story?
Absolutely. It was exactly the short story. And I think the interesting thing is when you clonk someone on the head with a lamp 30 pages in, the question really becomes, what do you do next? And how do you raise the stakes and also maintain that compression of a short story throughout the duration of a novel?
It begins with a dysfunctional Thanksgiving gathering. Why there and not Yom Kippur, which is obviously what your title refers to?
Well, I think it refers to the larger concept of may we be forgiven, which is not just Yom Kippur, which I think of as the holiday that precedes Thanksgiving, but the idea also that Thanksgiving is the time when families gather. It's, you know, the highest travel time in the United States, certainly. And I think it's the time when the fissures in the American family really show, more so even than Christmas.
Well, this is a family that has a lot of fissures.
Yes.
Your narrator is Harry Silver. Can you describe him?
Harry is a guy who I think has been waiting forever for his life to begin. And he literally says he's sort of waiting for life to happen. And it's sort of a wake-up call at the beginning of this book that he realizes, oh, he has to actually make his life. So I describe it in some ways as a midlife coming-of-age novel. Harry is a Nixon scholar. He's been working on this book about Nixon for years and ultimately actually loses his job in the course of the book when the chair fires him because history is becoming more future-forward and not so interested in the past.
Now, this is satire. So is that future-forward a satirical idea, or did somebody actually say something like that to you?
I think it's both satirical and also expresses my underlying concern that I think our process now is one in which we often make large-scale government decisions without really looking at what we've done in the past. And I think it's a problem if you're making a decision without being at least cognizant of what's come before in terms of even our relationships with other countries and you know, the aspect of China plays a big role in this book. You know, I think that we have to be cognizant of the past in order to be effective in the future.
Now, Harry is as I said, kind of distant, detached. Why did you want him to tell your story? Would you call him a reliable narrator?
I think he's certainly a reliable narrator. A lot of people have said to me, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to like him or not, which I find fascinating because I think, well, what point did literature change to one where we have to like the characters? I mean, I read like Crime and Punishment. I don't think, oh, lovely guy. I want to have lunch with him. So that's a very modern idea that we have to like them. But I think what's interesting to me about Harry is when I first started writing it, I remember thinking, why is this guy so hard? What's going on? And I realized I was writing about a person who didn't know himself and was entirely sort of closed down. And the wonder of it was that as Harry starts to get to know himself, literally he unfolds and the story unfolds.
A woman with whom he has slept has described him as charmingly out of it.
Exactly, yes.
So that gives you both things. You can make him a little bit of a ditz at the same time, somebody who isn't totally unlovable.
Absolutely. And I also think, you know, there's a bit where he goes on this internet dating bender. And I think that one of the things that interested me was our relationship to technology and the way in which many of us are a little bit out of it or more than a little bit. And something happens and we all of a sudden have to deal with how much the world has changed while we've been in it.
And this internet dating bender takes place in the suburbs.
It does, yes.
It's very different from what I understand internet dating is in the city.
I think what's fascinating is I did a lot of research and I found that internet dating and the specificity of what people were looking for varied city by city. And I was simultaneously in awe of and horrified by the detail with which people would put in their requests.
Well, you've lived in a number of major cities. You grew up in Washington.
Yes.
You've spent time in L.A. and lived here for much of your life.
Yeah.
Are they all that different? Could this this novel have taken place in Chevy Chase, where you grew up? Or does it have to be Westchester? Or can it be in the valley outside of L.A.?
Well, you know what I think is interesting is I think Los Angeles and Washington are very similar in the sense that they're company towns and they have sort of a dominant kind of culture, regardless of all the other things that happen. New York is a little bit different, and Westchester and sort of the Bronxville area, which is this is sort of a blend of Bronxville out to Scarsdale, I think still is kind of a bedroom community and was also very much about the sort of the dream of the suburb.
Now, Harry is very different from his brother, George. George is the one who lives in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And you've written about your times in the Hamptons. Is George the kind of person you would have met in the Hamptons?
I might have met George in the Hamptons, absolutely. George is a television executive who is one of those guys who I think of as alternately very fat and very thin, always bordering on out of control, you know, kind of an incredible bully. And he really comes undone in this book and then gets sent off to actually a mental hospital that closes to become an executive conference facility. And then he's sent to the woods.
He winds up killing a number of people,
yeah.
Some accidentally, some not accidentally.
Exactly. I think it's an open question if it's all accidentally on purpose.
Well, you've worked in television. Is this your revenge on television executives?
No, not at all. But I think that it's an interesting thing to look at how often there are people in kind of positions of incredible power who have really no social or familial skills at all.
Well, the book has no chapters. It's quite episodic in nature. Did that grow out of the writing you did on the series, The L Word?
No, I think that the writing on this book for me really was driven by the characters and the intensity and sort of the wanting to tell the story and it really becoming like a roller coaster ride. And then when I turned it in, the editor called me and he said, "Chapters?" And I thought, "Oh, I forgot 7 years and I forgot the chapters completely." So we put in space breaks where people could either, you know, get a snack or use the bathroom.
Yeah, well, Henry Fielding said that one of the reasons that you put in chapters is that it gives people something to strive for.
Right,
then
exactly.
They can ruminate on what they have read so far. They can look forward to reading something new the next day.
Yeah.
You didn't want to do that for us.
I didn't. And I like that people have been sort of, consuming this book almost in a couple of very big bites. People tell me they start and they really kind of can't put it down, which is a nice feeling. I only worry because it took so long to write that it'll be a long time till the next one.
My guess is A.M. Holmes, her latest book, May We Be Forgiven, did take her a long time to write. 7 years altogether?
7 years, yeah. 203,000 words, not that I counted.
Now, why did it take you so long?
You know, I think that this is a book with a lot of layers in it. And for me, I realize that I'm talking about, you know, the family and I'm talking about history and politics and the intersection of sort of social life and political life and fact and fiction, which is something I've always wanted to play with. But this time I really got in there.
And the American dream. That's something that Harry refers to often.
Yeah.
Why is he so preoccupied with it? Because he's not he feels he hasn't been given any part of that?
Well, you know, I still think the American dream is kind of one of those fascinations and misconceptions. I look at it as a sort of post-World War II thing that was an idea and it was a fantasy. And we sort of sold the American dream as in you will get, you know, a house and a car and a couple of kids. And we forgot that it was a dream and it became the American entitlement, which all of a sudden then became the incredible mortgage crisis and, you know, now we have a fiscal cliff. Who knows what's coming?
Well, living in the suburbs in a big house is part of the American dream for many people. And that happens for Harry only because his brother has been sent to jail. So
yes.
He takes over the house and inherits the family.
Yes, and he absolutely, literally, like, inherits the brother's clothing and lives in his shoes.
And at one point he has said, I feel like I've fallen into a space between spaces, like I don't really exist, I'm always out of context. Is this book to some degree about him finally finding the context?
Well, I think what's interesting is Harry is a teacher, and he's a good teacher, but he also learns to be a person, he learns to be a parent, and he actually grows up in a way that I don't think had ever happened before. He learns to take responsibility for things.
Like taking care of the dog.
Absolutely.
Or going to the mall.
Yes. Or his mother, you know. I love that the mother is actually in a nursing home, and he calls to see how she's doing. And the update is she's no longer bedridden, she's crawling, which I find, again, like a horrifying idea of an old woman crawling and that being progress. And then soon she's swimming again, and then she remarries.
Harry is also put in charge of his nephew and niece. He's never had any kids of his own. Does he try to become a different kind of parent than the others we meet in the novel?
I think so. I think the thing that Harry does that sets him apart is he actually tries to learn who the kids are, and I think they surprise him, and he surprises himself as well, which is the, you know, it's funny because it's a very dark book in many ways, but it's also the very human and sort of the upside of it all is that they become very real people, and they're engaged with each other.
At the end of the novel, Harry and the kids travel to South Africa for his nephew Nate's bar mitzvah. Why South Africa?
Well, Nate, early on, has gone on a school trip to a town in South Africa, and then it turns out he's been continuing to support the money through money he's siphoned through the school store at the boarding school where he goes, and so they've named it Nateville in his honor. And when he realizes that the local temple is no longer interested in hosting, essentially, you know, the bar mitzvah of the murdered neighbor and, you know, person in their community, I think he wants to go back to Nateville because it was a place where he remembered things being good. And then I love the fact that in Nateville, he offers them the money he's gotten for his bar mitzvah, and they want to buy a TV. And, of course, Nate wants them to dig a well or some, you know, good works thing.
But it's also the alternative to the town that he has grown up in.
Absolutely.
There's lots of satire in this book. It's about popular culture and American life in general. You told me that people sometimes confused about how to deal with satire.
Yeah, I think that we've gotten to a point sort of where people find it hard to parse both the simultaneous seriousness and humor of something. And I actually find that if you can make people laugh, you can be all that much more serious. It opens the door to another level of depth. But I'm not sure where we are with that in the culture at the moment. We seem to be very literal and kind of fact-based.
So you either write a realistic novel or you write a satire.
Yes.
And when you try to write something that is both realistic and satirical, people get confused about the boundaries.
Well, they also honestly seem to be confused about what fiction is because people say, oh, it's all true. Or are these Nixon short stories in there? Are they real? Did Nixon really write short stories? And I think, no, of course Nixon didn't write short stories. I wrote stories for Nixon.
Getting into Nixon's mind. That's part of what writers do, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's the best part.
Can you explain the title, Are the Characters Forgiven?
I think it's really about the largest idea of forgiving ourselves for the flaws in being human. And I think, you know, the energy that it takes to stay engaged in a grudge or an anger is enormous. And I think you have incredible freedom if you can let go of that. So it's a philosophical idea. It's not a mandate.
And this is a book about forgiveness and redemption. Do you see it as perhaps a bit more optimistic than some of your previous works, like The End of Alice, which was about a convicted pedophile murderer and a female college student?
Yeah. I mean, I think The End of Alice, it's interesting because that book, which came out in 1995 and was really about prompting the conversation about what is our responsibility as a society in a world where we have pedophiles, it's so incredibly still valid today between, you know, Jimmy Savile and Jerry Sandusky. But at the same time, for me as a fiction writer, I think the interesting quest is to be, how do you write optimistically at a time that's not inherently optimistic?
Are we going to have to wait another 7 years for the next book?
Maybe longer. I don't know.
Well, you wrote a memoir in between.
I did.
So is there a memoir to be written?
There might be more memoir. There's going to be a book. Actually, I'm writing a book about hospitals coming up next for a special series that Alain de Botton is doing. And I've been spending a lot of time sitting in on brain surgery, which I secretly love.
Alain Botton is interested in hospitals?
He's interested.
I thought he was only interested in Proust.
Well, Proust and airports and apparently sex and religion. So all the good things.
A.M. Holmes Her latest novel is May We Be Forgiven. It is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.